Okay, good afternoon. Hopefully you're all here for CS 30 through 30, and not some other class. That's what I'm going to be teaching. So I'm Charles Rice, Mr. Rice, Professor Rice, whatever you like. I'll be the sole instructor for this class this semester, unlike many prior semesters. And first, going to start out with sort of an introduction to the sort of topics we'll be covering this semester with a high-level view. So here we have one notion of the layers of abstractions that build up our computers. So at the bottom level, we have something physical, that there's some physical wires and gates and transistors and things you may or may not have learned about, especially depending on whether you took DLD or various physics classes. Where we have physical things that actually carry currents and voltages, and we somehow compose them into something which lets us run, C code, that has this sort of form that you're used to of high-level operations with named variables on things which aren't single values and single wires that you connect, but are just logical things you do with control flow. And in 2150, you learned a bit about assembly, which is what's used to implement that high-level languages like C and Java, ultimately. That this is our human-readable representation of what the hardware actually understands. And that assembly somehow goes down to a machine code. And you saw one sort of very toy-like example of a machine code in 2150. In this class, we'll have a slightly less toy-like example of a machine code. But the machine code is basically just a representation of that assembly as numbers, as bits, which is what our hardware is going to deal with. That we're going to take numbers and bits, basically bits, and represent them as values that actually exist on physical wires. And then we have something where we have some abstractions by which we're going to organize our gates, wires, and transistors so we can build whatever is going to take this machine code and actually do something useful with it. And that's what I have listed here as a bunch of question marks. So that's what we're dealing with in this class. And we're going to spend most of our semester talking about the stuff with all the question marks. But to start off, we're going to do a bit of review of C. So you had a very brief introduction to C and C++ in 2150. We'll be talking about some things you probably didn't pick up that are relevant to this class. And I'm going to first talk about why are we using C in this class. Like, this class is really about computer architecture, which means how we build like processors, how we build the physical hardware, how we design it. And why do we want to use a high-level language for that if our processor doesn't know how to take C code? It doesn't understand that. We have to write software called compilers and other software you might have heard of, like linkers, to make that possible. So why are we going to talk about this high-level language? So first, we're going to spend a little bit of time, not very much, talking about some parts of what that those compilers and linkers are doing, so you can understand sort of how things go from end to end. And secondly, we're going to choose one particular high-level language, which is C, because it happens to be good for talking about how assembly and machine code looks. So our reasons for choosing C in this class is one, that you basically already know it. It's almost a subset of C++. This isn't strictly true. There's C code, which is not valid C++. And obviously there's a lot of C++ code, which isn't valid C. For example, C doesn't have classes. The class keyword doesn't exist. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't have new delete, doesn't have IO streams. And yeah, there's some things in C which don't exist in C++, but it's close enough that you basically already know how to write useful programs in C, which is good because we're going to have occasions this semester we're going to have you write C code or modify C code or read C code. The reason we care about it in this class is that we have this kind of direct correspondence to assembly, that you can pretty much take a piece of C code and very mechanically translate it to assembly. This means that you can write a compiler for C, where modulo the task of actually like extracting the variables and such. The task of taking each statement and writing assembly is very straightforward relative to many other languages. So you can look at C code and say, here's some equivalent assembly. And you might imagine this is what C compilers do. Because if you can do the manual translation, surely that's what our compilers would do. And historically, that was true. Historically, compilers did this very straightforward translation from C to assembly, where like you take that plus equals and that's an add instruction. Easy. And most of the other things in C have that very straightforward translation where you can find an instruction which does each operation and just write it down. But we have this issue that compilers are, these days, more clever than that. So who's heard of optimizing compilers? So optimizing compilers are almost all modern compilers, so they don't do the straightforward thing, but they do something more clever with the hopes of being either faster or making smaller programs, or both. And most modern compilers are, at least if you pass the right flags, optimizing, and might not do the direct thing. So I'm warning you of this because we care about C because of this direct correspondence. That's why we're using it. We're using it to talk about sort of the straightforward assembly that will happen without looking at assembly code, which is really hard to read all the time. Because C is much easier for most of us to read. But if you use a compiler, you might not get that. The compiler might do something clever. We'll talk more about this later in the semester, that is not a straightforward thing to do and is not what you expect to happen. And that's because the compiler thinks it's faster to do that. Okay. And since we're using C in this course, one thing you need to do by next week is have access to some C environment. So our supported option for this is that we're going to give you lab accounts. So I know that most of you have probably received emails about lab accounts, and those accounts might not work because apparently there's a problem. This should be resolved by Monday, next Monday at the latest, and hopefully earlier. But we will get you lab accounts so you can use the lab in Olson 1 and also access it remotely. This is our supporting mechanism for all assignments in this course where you need to use some machine. So if you have problems, like getting something working in your own machine, we're going to tell you, use the lab accounts, use remote login. This is supported because we have people in Bryce Hall who we can go to and say, this lab account is broken, or this student can't SSH in, fix it. But you can also have a Linux environment on your laptop or some other Unix-like environment, OS X probably will work, where you can run commands on a Unix-like command line and have a C compiler. Or some students have had success using an online IDE. So there's a course website, which is linked off Colab. Which I will do this. And on the website, under the schedule, for lab, there's a schedule, which is probably where you you'll find things like labs, and we have a link to install C before the next lab. in place of actually going to Lab in Alston 1. If you go to Lab in Alston 1, you'll be disappointed because no one will be there. So that's your task, to be able to do the assignments in this course. Please get that working by next lab, which we'll talk about probably Thursday or next Tuesday. So any questions about this task? Okay. So as I said, our assignments are supported on the lab machines. Many, many people have used laptops. And usually it's a CNE Unix-like environment. We'll have a tool that we wrote that is not written in C, written in something called Rust, but we'll provide you binaries, so you shouldn't need to have the ability to use any language other than C. And if you've heard from people in previous semesters, we previously had you install a compiler for a language called D because we had a tool that needed you to have that installed. This should not be the case this semester. You heard from people from last semester. We'll have some assignments where you'll probably really need to use the lab machines. Later in the semester, we'll tell you about them when we get closer to that. So going back to our high-level overview, so I told you why we want to use C in this course, that we have this idea that we're using C because it's sort of a shorthand for assembly, and it's much easier to understand, and pretty much maps directly to assembly. We're also going to deal with assembly language. In particular, in this course, we'll happen to be using x86 64 assembly, so 64-bit x86 assembly. So in theory, you know this because we teach it in 2150. In reality, we've had mixed experiences. And there's one important technical difference, which is in 2150, there was a time, not too far long ago, when 2150 covered 32-bit x86. Who here took 2150 when that was the case? Okay, so we're finally done with that. So I don't need to talk about the differences. But there's also 32-bit x86 assembly, which is different than 64-bit in some minor ways, and we use 64-bit in this course. Okay. So in theory, you know it. x86 assembly. In practice, we've discovered that there may be holes in what people learn in 2150, and people forget a lot. As part of dealing with this, our first lab and the following homework, which is very related to the lab, will be dealing with a binary and looking at it in a debugger and an assembly to figure out what it does and how to provide inputs which make it produce the right output, which will involve understanding assembly and hopefully refresh your memory of what you may or may not have learned in 2150. Okay. So after this, we have our machine code. And you notice that this picture says Y86. So what the heck is Y86? So Y86 is a machine code invented by our textbook, which I should point out. We have a textbook for this course, which will come up. Our textbook here, which is kind of like x86, but is a subset. So there's a Y86 assembly language, which is basically just part of 64-bit x86, but we've removed some things that are complicated. Most notably, x86, you probably don't know this from 2150, has like 4,000 instructions or something like that. It's ridiculously huge. And Y86 is not, which is good because one of our biggest assignments in this class will be to construct an implementation of Y86 in a hardware simulator. And you'd be really annoyed if we had you implement 1,000 instructions. It also has a machine code that is much, much simpler than the x86 machine code. So I'm not going to talk about in this class how x86 machine code actually looks, but it's way more complicated than it needs to be, because what happened is Intel produced a 16-bit chip called like the 8086, and then produced a chip that built off of this over and over again, and they kept the machine code mostly compatible. So they somehow went from having 4 general purpose registers to 16 without, you know, completely changing the machine code format, and that makes the machine code look really weird. So we're going to have an encoding which was designed fresh just for 64-bit x86, so it's not going to have that problem. But it's still not really a simple machine code. So in 2150, you had this ICBM, I think that's the name, machine code. Questions? IBCM, okay. IBCM. This is going to be different than that. So it's going to be variable length. Instructions are going to take different amounts of bits, which is like real x86. We have not just a very small number of registers, we have 15 available registers for instructions. So we're going to have that in the machine code somewhere. We're going to have to put what registers are we accessing. We have actual conditional jumps, just like x86. So we have to have all the support for doing, you know, greater than, less than, and so on. And we have push and pop like x86, which is way more complicated than any instruction in IBCM. So any questions about this basic look at 486? So we have this simplified machine code, as I said, because we're going to tackle that question marks there. We're going to actually look at designing hardware that deals with it. And that's going to take up most of our semester, is talking about how we build that hardware. And as you might guess from this picture, we're going to not focus on the thing at the bottom. I'm assuming that that's something that's taught in other courses. We're going to have a higher level of abstraction. So if you took 2330, which you do not have to do to take this course at all, then you would have learned how to build like an adder. We are not going to care how you make a circuit that adds things. We're just going to assume that you can do it and that you can use it, someone else will build it. We're going to deal with a higher level of abstraction than that, where we're just going to say, we put an adder here, it's there, that's all we care about. So we're going to spend most of our semester talking about that sort of higher level of connecting hardware components to build a processor which can take our machine code and actually execute it like we expect to have it. So a common question with this course is, given what I've told you this course is about, why should I care? I'm never going to design hardware, which is true for most of you. There's not many people who have jobs designing hardware. Why should I care about this class? Why do I want to know this? What's going to be useful that I'm going to get out of this when I go to do some ordinary software development or something? So we have some goals of things that you should get out of this class, even if you don't actually care about how processors are built directly. But you do care about our normal, you know, software development things that most of the rest of the CS program seems to be focused on, or at least people think they need to know to get jobs, etc. And this is about understanding how hardware works so you understand what the hardware is going to do with your programs. And one very important aspect of this is understanding program performance. So unless you understand what's actually happening in the hardware to execute your program, you're not going to understand why it's fast or slow. And this is the different type of fast or slow than you may have dealt with elsewhere. So in prior courses, you learned like big O. This is a different sort of aspect than that. This is not about sort of number of operations. This is about sort of the more micro level. Like why are some things, you know, 5 times slower than others? Not big O slower, but, you know, why are some operations in the hardware slower or not? Which ones are? How do I make my programs use the right ones? You know, how do I take advantage of what the hardware can do well? So these are things you learn in this course. And the big ideas with that are going to be about learning how our naive model of program performance doesn't work on processors built in like the last 30 years. So our naive idea that you might have from having learned assembly in 2150 is that, well, that's, you know, these assembly, these instructions are actually what the hardware deals with. So the speed of my program is just the number of instructions it executes. And it used to be common for processors to work this way. It used to be the case you could just count instructions and that's how fast the program would be. But that's not how modern processors work. And there's two big issues which cause that to happen. So one issue is parallelism. So modern hardware designs does multiple things at once. It can like add two numbers at the same time. It can execute part of one instruction and part of another instruction at the same time. But it can't always do this. It obviously depends on the instructions. You can't add two numbers at the same time if you need to get the result of the first add and use it to do the second add. It doesn't work. So it needs multiple things to do. So one thing you as a programmer can actually do to make your programs faster is make sure the hardware can take advantage of being able to do multiple things at a time. But to do that, you need to know what things can the hardware do at the same time, what can't it. So we need to know how that parallelism works. Another big aspect is caching. So processors can do computation really, really quickly, but they can't store large amounts of data really quickly. So you might know about memory, for example. These memory chips, they're separate from the processor chip, which does the computation, and they're a little bit away. And because our processors are so fast these days, the time it takes for our electrical signals to get to the memory chip is the time we can do like hundreds of additions just to get a signal to the memory chip and back. And so to make things fast, the processors need to have data cached. They need to have copies of commonly used data close to the processor, and whether things go in that extra fast copy of the data or not is going to affect the speed of your program, possibly by a factor of like 100, because that is how slow like memory is compared to our computations. And in other classes, you learn about algorithmic efficiency, so we're not going to focus on that. That's something which helps you whether or not you take advantage of this, but these are orthogonal to that. So in addition to taking advantage of, you know, being algorithmically faster, not using an n squared algorithm when you can use an n log n one, taking advantage of this will get you a further speed up. It won't be asymptotic, but it can make a big difference and will help you understand how to make your programs as fast as they need to be. So another thing you should learn in this course is what compilers are and do. So if you have weird compiler or linker errors, this will help you a lot, hopefully, maybe. But you should have more of an idea of what the compiler is doing, so when you get this error about an undefined symbol, you know what that means is happening. Since you will know more about how we go from a C program to a binary that we can actually have the hardware interpret directly. This also should be helpful if you want to make compilers. If you want to make compilers, it really helps to know what the hardware is going to do with what you provide and, you know, how other compilers have solved these problems. And it also might help you in debugging applications. When you're debugging a compiled program, it's actually assembly instructions, and sometimes it's helpful to look at that and figure out what's going on, or at least know what those look like, so you understand, like, why are these addresses where they are, things like that. And a third thing that is practically useful is that we'll talk a bit about sort of weird program behaviors. What happens when your program does something that's misbehaving? Why does that happen? You know, why does it manifest as things like seg faults? So seg faults are part of a hardware feature to help operating systems and are things which happen when your program does something that's sort of not designed. So we'll talk about how that works in the hardware, and that should help you understand when your program does that, what's happening. How is the operating system doing that? What in your program could cause that, et cetera? And this also is useful to know about how you, if you want to write operating systems. So operating systems need to have the hardware help them control what programs do. And part of that is the operating system support, which makes seg faults happen instead of just crashing the whole machine. So any questions about any of these motivations for learning about hardware? So if not, I'll move on to a different topic, which is about powers of two. So I have this here. You know, it's not really about hardware. But this is useful to know because in hardware, we're going to deal with lots of powers of two, especially when we talk about caching later in the semester. So we think it's helpful for you to have some idea what they are and how to quickly convert from normal numbers to powers of two. It's a useful skill if you ever do programming and also later in the course. And it would be useful, I find it useful to have memorized, memorize the, these first powers here, the 1 through 0 through 10. And we'll also use a bit of the SI prefixes, so K for kilo, M for mega, G for giga. So in this class, typically when we use K, M, or G, we're going to mean the power of 2K, the power of 2M, and the power of 2G. And you might complain, well, that's technically not right. And well, there is sort of a, if you're really pedantic, solution that many people like of kiba instead of kilo, abbreviated KI, MIBA instead of mega, abbreviated MI, which you might see sometimes. In this class, we're just always going to mean a power of two because our computers deal with powers of two because we have numbers that are represented by bits. And a helpful thing with these prefixes is that if you memorize these 1 through 10 and know what the prefixes are, know K is 10, 2 to the 10, M is 2 to the 20, G is 2 to the 30, then you can easily convert from sort of the human readable form to the power of 2. So, for example, if I know I have 2 to the 35 of something, that's 2 to the 30 times 2 to the 5. And if I just have memorized that 2 to the 5 is 32, and I know 2 to the 30 is G for giga, that's 32G, 32 giga, whatever, bytes, bits, whatever we're dealing with. Okay. So as an exercise, why don't you try to do the remaining conversions? And I was just writing things down. I'm not going to check. And check your answers with a neighbor. I guess it will. Okay, so that's hopefully enough time for some people to have answers. So who wants to tell us about how you do the second one, 2 to the 21? Or what, just what the answer is, yeah.
I got 2M.
2M, yeah. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna say, okay, there's 2 to the 20 times 2 to the 1. So 20 is M, and 2 to the 1 is 2. So we do. And for 2 to the 9, that's one of the ones I would recommend memorizing. So it's 512, but if you don't have that memorized, one way to, if you know that 512 is a power of 2, one way to memorize that it's 9 is knowing that 2 to the 10 is about 1,000, so 512 is about 1 minus that, and less power of 2. And for 2 to the 14, so we're going to use the same sort of logic. We're going to say, we're going to take the 1 means that it's 2 to the 10 times something, 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 4, 2 to the 4 is 16, 2 times 2 is 4, that times 2 times itself is 16, and that gives us 16k. So, I'm telling you about this because doing this in this sort of way is way more reliable, for example, on an exam, or even, in any other context, than actually trying to do the division from actually figuring out what 2 to the 35 is in decimal. Certainly never want to do that, and probably even figuring out what 2 to the 14 is in decimal, even though you can write that down. It's because that's just because that's so error prone and time consuming. Another thing to note is that you can do this process backwards. So you can go from something like 16g and figure out what power of 2 that is. So you can say, oh, I have 16g, g, this is, remember, is 2 to the 30. So we can just say that we get 16 times 2 to the 30. We figure out what power of 2 is 16. In this case, it's 2 to the 4, so that gives us 2 to the 34. And we can do the same process for all these others. So we can say with k, that's 2 to the 10. So 128 times 2 to the 10. We can figure out that 128 is 2 to the 7, which I would recommend memorizing, but is at least a much easier calculation than if you computed 128,000, whatever, 129,000 and whatever it is, and then tried to divide by 2 repeatedly. And you figure out that's 2 to the 17. So what's our next one? 4m. Sorry? No. 22. So how do you get that? Okay. 4 is 2. It's not 4, which is surely the error I would accidentally make by hand. And for 256t, 256 is 2 to the 8th, the number of possible values for bytes. That's how I memorize it. And t tera, that's 2 to the 40. Because it's 2 to the 10, 2 to the 20, 2 to the 30, 40, and so on. So if you know your SI prefixes, you can map that way. Okay. So that's our brief interlude into powers of 2. So I'm telling you about this because there will come up a bunch of times where we're going to care about, powers of 2 because we have some number of bits and we care about what values are represented using those bits. And you'll need to do conversions in both directions. And I really don't like seeing people on exams you know, dividing things by two over and over and over again, or multiplying by two, and things like that. Also to remind you that in this class, when we write 4m for something, we generally mean m as in 2 to the 20, not m as in a million. Just because there's no point in this class where it's really going to make sense for us to work with powers of 10. Any questions? Some people look confused about this. Okay, so for the rest of this class, I'm going to give sort of a brief preview of circuits and how CPUs, sort of their basic functionality, talking a little bit about, you know, how we take gates and make them do computation that like CPUs do. Talk a bit about assembly and linking, so a bit about the sort of compilation process we alluded to and how that works, and what's in these various files you may have generated but never actually really looked at. And then we're going to talk about, as I mentioned earlier, selected topics about C that you probably didn't pick up in 2150 that we want you to eventually know. So let's first talk a little bit about wires. This class is not going to be about like wires and gates really, but we need to know something about how they work because we're going to build things that are eventually built out of them. We're not going to talk about exactly how you like add numbers together, but we need to talk about like what does it mean for a wire to have value on it? What does that mean? So our wires in this class are just going to hold zeros and ones. So the wire holds this, each of these wires holds a binary value, which is actually represented by a voltage in hardware. We're not going to care about how the physics actually works as far as this class concerns. They just hold zero and one. And values propagate from one side one wire to all other sides down the wire with some negligible delay. Yes. So that if we have a value, if we put a value zero on one side of the wire, the other side will get that value. So that's the level of abstraction we'll deal with. That's not quite how the physics actually works exactly, but as far as we're concerned, that's what we're going to care about. And we're going to group these wires together because it's not very convenient when you're designing a processor that works in 64-bit values to draw diagrams with 64 lines. I would not be happy if I showed you a processor diagram with 64 lines carrying value from the first register and another 64 wires carrying the value from the second register. You couldn't read anything, so we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to bundle these together. So you can imagine that, you know, we could draw the lines closer together. And instead of writing a 0 or 1 to represent the value that's on that wire, we're going to write something like 26, saying that these wires together represent the value 26. And they represent them as a binary number where each of the separate wires has one of the bits of the number, one of the places. And we'll take an even more of a shortcut, and we'll just draw a single wire and pretend it holds this wide value. But really, that single wire represents a bundle of wires of the appropriate width. So any questions about this? This abstract, yeah.
How do you determine what the value is?
So the value, we just could read the bits. So in this case, I know it's 26 because I have 11010. Which, if I didn't mess up the slide, is 26 in binary. And that's, you know, we're going to do that translation. This representation doesn't show you how many bits are in the bundle of wires. We'll usually not care about that. That is a concern, obviously. So this is the level of abstraction which will draw pictures of wires connecting things together, because there's so much time where we actually want to deal with, you know, 64-bit wide values or 4-bit wide values, and it would be really annoying to have pictures with wires everywhere when we don't actually care about that level of detail. Yeah?
Assume the binary representations are unsigned integers instead of like just complement or some other representation.
So the question is, what is, you know, is this unsigned? Is it to his complement? So generally, I will write an unsigned integer, but this is not unambiguous. We will specify if we need to. So that's our level of abstraction for dealing with circuits. So the other thing we need to do with circuits, besides have wires with values, is that we need to actually perform computations. Our computer would not be very useful if it couldn't say add. And our basic component for that are things called gates. So who has taken something where you learned what this symbol I have here repeated means? Okay, who can volunteer to tell me what it is? Yeah. Exclusive OR. So this is just a symbol that people have chosen to represent what is an exclusive OR operation, which takes in two values, outputs another value. And we can build hardware where we have physical wires going into something and a physical wire coming out, which causes this to happen. Where if we put the zero value on the incoming wires, we get a zero out. If we put a zero on one incoming wire and a one on the other, we get a one out. And this is sort of what some physical thing implements. And kind of like a wire, we put a value on the put values on the input wires here, and with some delay, the output wire has the corresponding result of the computation. So it's from things like this that we build up all the computation we do in our machines. And we're going to generalize this when we talk about circuits. So when I draw pictures of circuits, I'm not going to draw gates, typically, maybe a few times. I'm generally just going to like have a box, and I'm going to say, that box does something. So that box computes something. So there's some weird, complicated function. I would represent applying that function to 12 with a picture like this. I just have a box, which presumably has a whole bunch of gates in it, and you could learn how to do that in 20 through 30. We're not going to care about what's inside that box. Our level of abstraction is that if I have some computation I want done that, you know, that works on bits, I can build a circuit to do that. I'm not going to care what that circuit does, but it's going to take in some wires, output some wires, and from that, I'm going to be able to actually, you know, build up my processor. Yeah?
So is 12 a wire?
So 12 is this is a bundle of wires, even. Just so this is exactly a use of this sort of abbreviation, because if you imagine me representing, you know, all the wires necessary to carry 12 in this picture, that would make this picture very messy. And that's why I have that abbreviation. And when I show these, you know, so it's going to compute some function. It's not even always going to be the case that the number of bits in the input wires are the same as the outputs, even though that might not show up on this picture. Okay, any questions about this sort of shorthand representation and what we're not covering about circuits? Apparently not. Okay, so let's go through an example. So let's try to, you know, use these sorts of abstractions to build a counter, the simplest thing our computer can do. Just add one to something repeatedly. Okay. And, you know, so this is a logical way to build a counter. We have some input wires, which, you know, we put some value on and have an output. And we have this block of logic, which I see implements the add one function by taking in some wires and outputting some wires. And let's say, you know, at time zero, we're going to have all zeros. Let's say this bundle of wires around is 3 bits. So let's say it's all zeros at time zero. Then at some time one, we're going to have 001. Then we're going to have 010 and 011. So I have question marks there. So what might be wrong with this idea? So this is what we want, and this is what we think should happen, but what's probably actually going to happen? Any ideas? You think about this. So back there?
In that first
Which, so the, so you have the, you have a, so this first bit?
No, I'm saying when it goes from 001 to 011.
Here. So why would that not happen? Okay, you're just adding incorrect?
Three separate wires, right?
Yeah.
Those bits are different wires. So you're adding one.
So, okay, so, yeah, so I guess the question is, we have three separate wires. So the idea is that this add one, we have one, and it really does, it takes in three separate wires and outputs three separate wires, but the goal is that if we have these wires collectively represent two, we should get three. And if these correct, you know, that's what that piece of logic does. But you're right to think about, oh, these are separate wires. Does that mean something? No. You have a comment?
Do we need memory?
So the question is, do we need memory? So what is memory, first of all?
It's a way to store the information.
Okay. Okay, so
the function is just like adding one each time. We need to store what it added to.
Okay, so you're saying you think you might need to store the value we added to. Okay, so that's interesting thought. So one way that we can say is that we kind of have memory because wires have a value on them. That's sort of a sort form of memory, but is there some problem with that? Yeah.
Yeah, the input and the output are the same physical wires.
Okay.
Make a whole lot of sense. So you can't have a wire store 0 and 1 plus 0 at the same time.
Yeah, so that's a problem. So our problem here is that this is the same wire. So that's going to be an issue. So as we compute our output, we're changing our input. That is maybe not so great. So a question might be, how are we going to deal with that? And what's going to happen? So first question, what's going to happen to this? So if our adder changes the output, you know, we might say, well, maybe, because I told you it takes a little bit of time for values to propagate in a wire. When we put a value on a wire, it's going to take a little bit of time for it to go down. We might imagine that this actually happens, just because the value goes down the wire and it takes long enough. But that's very unlikely. And so what we usually say is that this circuit isn't stable. So we don't know what's going to happen. It's precisely because those wire, it's the same wire. But more importantly, when we have our our adder here, we're going to have what some of our members are called transient values. That when we go from, when this goes from 0, 0, 1 to 0, 1, 0, there's going to be some intermediate state. The wire is not going to instantaneously change from 1 to 0 and 0 to 1. And these two wires probably aren't even going to change at the same time. So we have this issue that we're giving these crazy inputs of like halfway between 0 and 1, and it's not clear what this logic is going to do with that. And we have to change those values in some order. They probably don't change exactly at the same time. And that's going to cause this circuit to do weird things. You know, we can't really transition between these two values without having, you know, one of the bits change at a different time. Yeah?
So I'm just a little confused. It takes an input, right? And then it adds one, and then you have your output.
Yeah.
So isn't the whole idea to change your input so you get the proper output? Like you're adding one to the input to get the output.
Yeah, so the question, so...
And so I'm just a little confused as to why you can't change
the input. So the question is, since we change the input, why can't we just have the output change? And the issue is that we can change the input, but we're not going to be able to change it instantaneously. That we're going to have, if we look at, say, if we have this wire, it's going to be 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, or something like that. Uh-huh. And this wire might be something like 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, if we sample it repeatedly. Like, we'll have this little period where things aren't quite synchronized. And that's very hard to avoid. Like, we can't get things precisely aligned. So we'll always have a little bit of variance. And as this circuit keeps running, that will add up, and the circuit will stop producing sensible values. And this is very likely for something like an adder, because it might be faster to produce the results for this wire than this wire. Just a little bit faster. That would make sense, because it's easier to compute the low bit of an addition than the high bit. So we expect them to happen at different speeds. Yeah?
I'm still a little confused, but are you kind of saying that this just making a counter with wires just doesn't work?
Yeah, so it just doesn't work, and it's because of the timing. Because we don't have things are not going to be synchronized right. And someone alluded to the solution, which is storage. And the issue isn't that we don't have any place to put values. The issue is that we don't have places to put values at well-known times, right? That, yeah, we have a wire which will hold a value, but it's going to change all the time. We need to be able to change the value. We need to be able to have our input stay the same while we're changing our output, and have these things be synchronized. No. So our solution is going to be to add state. So our problem, one way of looking at it, is that our logic performs calculations all the time. Like, it's always doing something with its inputs, trying to produce a new output. Whenever there's any little change on its inputs, it's immediately starting to change its output a bit. But that means if we connect it directly to each other, it's going to be changing all the time. So we need extra elements to store values in a controlled way, so we can only care about some fixed value and have that stored. And we're going to have an abstraction called a register to do that. And this is the picture, that thing with a triangle at the bottom, is how I'm going to represent registers in this class. And when we add that to the circuit, we're going to get something which actually behaves correctly. And the fix is that this register is going to output a consistent value for a long time. That as its inputs change, it's not going to immediately change its outputs. So it's going to delay things appropriately. So we always have a consistent input until we know what the result of the addition is. And then when we have that result, the register is going to let us store the inputs without paying attention to how they change after we tell it to do that, and then continue to output them while its inputs start changing again. So there's going to be a signal that we generally won't draw, called a clock signal, which is going to tell the register, at this point in time, I want you to read your input and start outputting it from now on. So the register is going to pick particular points in time when the values put out by our logic aren't changing to read a value and store it. And this is the sort of memory that's going to make our circuit consistent. And this avoids those problems with values changing, keeps us from worrying about what happens between 0 and 1. Is there some value in between that does something different? Don't have to worry about that, because we're only going to be concerned about the value when these clock signal happens, and we're going to make sure that that's not changing, that we've kept the input the same for long enough that the output's staying the same and we don't have to worry. So any questions about this? So this idea of adding this state to basically synchronize when we update our circuit, even though the addition would naturally compute all the time, brings up a point about hardware. That hardware, mentioned parallelism earlier, hardware is inherently parallel. our pieces of logic, you know, if we have an adder and a multiplier, those things, they compute all the time, they compute at the same time. There's no notion that I'm running an add instruction so I can't multiply now. If you have a separate adder and multiplier, they're always doing it all the time. And most of our work in hardware design is going to be making it sequential again. We're going to be taking these pieces of logic, which compute all the time, and we're going to be putting this temporary storage in between them so we can make it act like it does one step at a time, where each step is, when do we put things in the storage? So we're going to take a bunch of these apparently parallel pieces of logic, connect them to temporary storage, so they only do one step at a time, just like we kind of expect instructions to do. And then we're going to be undoing this to make our hardware faster so we can take advantage of it being in parallel. But our first step to run instructions, which are one at a time after all, is going to be to have this sort of structure where we deliberately, you know, act like the logic does something and then we store the value, even though that's not actually how it works physically. Any questions about this idea? Okay. And since we're talking about parallelism, let's talk about generally how to think about parallelism. And this will come up more later in the semester, but we're gonna, as I said, be taking advantage of parallelism in hardware. And this is a general concept which just comes up in a lot of places, in even outside hardware, because this is also how you make software fast. An important thing to think about is bottlenecks. So if I have some serial program, which takes 7 time units, and let's say I can make the blue part of that faster. I can do it. I can make it faster by parallelizing it. I can divide it up into 5 pieces, do all those pieces at the same time. Well, now I've gone from 7 time units to 3 time units. And let's say I can do that twice as good. So instead of making it, dividing it up into 5 pieces and being able to do them all at the same time, I can get it down to 10 times faster. Well, now I got it from 2 time units. So a 2x improvement gives me a 50% improvement in speed. So you can sort of figure this sort of thing out by looking, making diagrams like this. There's this general idea that we have these bottlenecks, that we have this extra time at the beginning and at the end of our operation. Sometimes it's in the middle, but this extra minor looking thing that suddenly becomes significant when we manage to speed up the important thing. So we have the bottlenecks being created as we manage to optimize the big part of our computation. And this is a general pattern we're going to see when we talk about performance in general, and it also comes up a lot in hardware, that we're going to care about whatever is making us slow. That's usually going to be, you know, things which were originally very minor problems. Like, if you looked at this execution at the beginning, you'd say, well, it doesn't really matter how fast the red and green parts are. But after you get all this parallelism to speed up the rest, all of a sudden, those little bits of overhead that seemed minor really matter. Yeah?
Are all these pictures related?
Yeah, so the idea is this is all the same amount of blue and red and green stuff in each picture. So the idea is we have some program where we do something for 1 unit of time, then 5 units of time, then 1 unit of time. So it takes 7 units. You have another program where we do something for 1 unit of time, and then we've taken that 5 unit of time thing and divided it up into 5 pieces, and we do them all at the same time. We have 5 computers, we split out the work up, do it all at the same time. So it takes 1 unit, and then we still have to do the green stuff. And here, we divide it up into 10 pieces, so it takes 0.5 units, but we still have to do the green stuff. Or 2.5. Okay, math. Make sense? And this is a common pattern we'll see when we talk about performance. Yeah? Question?
Are
No. Okay. Yes. So the question is, do the red, green, and blue represent something? Not in particular, so this applies in general, but this pattern of you have to set up some computation, then you have some long computation, then you have to, get your result back is very common. And we'll see something like this in hardware. So one thing which happens in hardware is we need to read values from storage, do some computation, and write values to storage. So that would be a common thing that might be representing the red and green would be accessing that storage. And if you make the computation really fast, with lots of parallelism, you get this problem. That suddenly you really only care about how fast your storage is. But this general observation is something that's very important, known as Amdahl's law, which is that the benefits of any sort of optimization you do are limited by whatever parts you can't optimize. So you're always sort of playing this whack-a-mole game where, yeah, that is the slow part, fixed it, and now something else is really slow and making your program slow. And it doesn't matter how much extra work you do to that original thing. You just suddenly just care about a new slow part. So this is an observation which comes up in lots of places, not just hardware. It's why we're talking about it. So any questions about this? And the idea is that if we have, that as this parallelism increases, we still pay for the serial part. Like this term ends up dominating. As we increase parallelism, or you can replace parallelism with like how much you speed something up by like doing an algorithmic optimization, like changing something from n squared to n log n. Okay. Okay, so after our divergence into parallelism, go back to talking about a bit about hardware and where our computers are built up. So I showed you about these circuits, which are built from this logic, which is computing all the time, and we have this temporary storage, so we can make the logic behave as if we're doing things step by step by step. That we're adding, and then adding again, not adding all the time, and who knows what the values are. So we have our central processing unit. Basically, we have some logic which talks back and forth between the logic and registers over and over again, and that's how it works. We also have some longer-term storage, most notably main memory, which it also talks to, and that's how it communicates with the rest of the world. Like, it has some connection, so you can output something to your screen that's mediated by what I'm drawing as memory on this picture. And so that's actually how we're going to construct a computer. So our logic is going to end up taking machine code and data, and the computation it does is going to end up running the instructions in our machine code. And we're just going to have to figure out how to build the pieces of logic which take in machine code and produce out the results of the machine code. That's our task as hardware designers. And there's a general organization of computers. So we have something like a processor. So you've heard of processors before. So this is a die photo of a 2004 processor, 2001, pretty old processor. So this is a micro photograph. The real thing is like a millimeter square or something. This is a micrograph of a real processor, and you have memory. If you've ever seen memory chips, this is often what they look like. And the processor is connected via a bunch of wires physically to that memory. And that memory is where most of its data is stored, though as I said, the processor also has storage on it, like registers. And the processor has logic and storage, and it sends things to the memory, saying, hey, I'd like to get some data, and the memory will send back some data, and so on. And this is how it stores lots of information that we can't fit in our processor. Of course, yeah.
What is
The memory bus, so that's the set of wires that come out of the processor and go to the memory. Yes, so that's the name for that bundle of wires there. So another thing our processors do is they don't just communicate with external memory. They don't just store values. That wouldn't be very useful. A processor where you can just store values and read values and not do anything else, you wouldn't use. So what else do we want to do? What are we missing here in this picture that you like have in your laptop? Yeah. So you talk about an arithmetic logic unit. That's in the processor. The processor has logic to do computation. That's there. There's something else we're missing, which many people find more important for their computers. Cache. That's in the processor. So that's a good thought. Something even more important than cache. Yeah.
Input output.
We don't have a keyboard hooked up to this. You know, how do we use this computer is not very useful because we can't actually get the data in or out. So like this is even more important than a cache, which we definitely have. It's in this picture, this whole thing here, that periodic pattern is a cache. But we actually need to be able to move data to things like keyboards and screens and networks. And the way that works on typical modern computers is that's basically the same bundle of wires that talk to memory, also is connected somehow to the keyboard, to the screen, and that's what the processor uses to talk to those devices. So there's extra hardware that's built, and the processor does something that looks the same as accessing a location in memory. It says, here's an address, I would like to do something with the value at that address. And it happens to actually deal with the keyboard because it's physically connected to the keyboard and the keyboard can handle that. So we have something often called a system bus where you send what thing you want to talk to, is it's memory or if it's an IO device, and you get back some data or you put some data. You say, here's the thing I would like to put on the screen, or hey, why don't you tell, here's, hey, I would like you to give me what key was just pressed. That sort of information. Yeah?
So you're saying that the actual electrical connection between the processor, memory, and all the other devices are all the same physical wires? They're just bridged over some sort of like.
So this is slightly a simplification, but often they're the same physical wires. This is not necessarily true all the time. There's usually lots of intermediate hardware, like this I/O bridge thing I drew. I'm not telling you how it works. Yeah, there's some sort of hardware that we won't design in this class that handles how do I know what device to communicate and all that stuff. And so what our processor is doing basically is that it's computing things. So it's computing things to send and receive from this bus, from I/O devices and memory. That's all it does, is it just talks to memory and I/O. It says, for example, hey, I'd like to read the instruction at this address. So it says, hey, here's an address, memory, give me the instruction. And it gets back, here's some machine code for the push instruction. Runs the push instruction, says, I'd like to get the next one. Here's my next thing to get. And it occasionally says, hey, I'd like to read this address, and our magical hardware knows, oh, that's the keyboard. The keyboard sends something back, and it says, yep, here's your keystroke. But it's just talking, it's just sending signals on this bus and waiting for a response back. That's all our processor is really doing. And I am simplifying a bit, but there might be an extra bus or something like that, but that's basically all we're doing is choosing what to send on a wire and waiting for a response back on that set of wires. Okay. And in our remaining time, I will go through some logistics since 12:30, Okay, so our approximate outline for what we're covering this semester is that first couple weeks, we're going to review C in assembly, as I mentioned. Then we're going to talk about, you know, actually building our hardware. We're going to start by looking at the instruction machine code set and machine code we're going to use, talk a bit about bit manipulation, and look into basic CPU design, designing, just making a circuit that works. We'll have one midterm, then we'll talk about making that into something parallel, something faster. And we'll talk about caching, so making memory fast. And we'll have some miscellaneous topics in the last third of the course. So coursework. So there's going to be weekly quizzes for this class starting after class on Thursday. Mind you again then. There will be pre-quizzes on the readings. So hopefully you actually do the readings. There will be post-quizzes on whatever we covered this week in lecture, which we posted probably sometime after the last lecture, which is it ends at 4:45. Yes?
Do you post your slides online?
The question is, do I post my slides online? Yes, I will post my slides, an audio recording, and a screen recording synced with the audio recording. Okay. So we'll also have labs. So labs are graded based on, did you make some amount of progress in the lab? You know, that, you know, not like took the lab solution and uploaded the lab, took the lab, you know, handout and uploaded it. That's not going to count. But did you make some reasonable progress? Labs are collaboration permitted. You are welcome to work with other people in your lab, as many as you like on the lab. It's perfectly fine. We also have homework assignments. For most homework assignments, there will be a lab which will be suspiciously like the first part of the homework, and then a homework assignment. Homeworks will be due by noon on the next lab day, so before any of the labs, and are to be done individually. You are not to share code on homeworks unless we explicitly tell you otherwise. You may ask general questions, but we shouldn't look at your solutions and say, yeah, these people definitely work together on the homeworks. We'll also have exams. Exams will generally be multiple choice and short answer. There's two and a final. Yes? No? No questions? Okay, so a note on a common complaint with this course is that our labs and homeworks aren't quite synchronized with the lectures. I'm trying to make it better. The main issue is that we want to like actually cover a topic before we have you do it in lab and homework. And we're, it varies how much, you know, I can make that be like just before versus like a week or two before. I'm sorry, I welcome suggestions on how to adjust the schedule to fix it. Taken some of them in the past, so let me know. I'll talk more about quizzes next time. I should note attendance. So attendance in lecture is strongly recommended, but I'm not checking. Attendance, you know, I record them so you know, can review. Attendance in lab, we check that you submitted something. The submission is electronic with one exception, which we will tell you about. It's electronic and can be done out of lab with one exception. And I don't actually care if you come to lab. I'm only going to check that it's submitted by the night of the lab. I'm not even going to check whether it's submitted by your lab time. Just whether it's submitted by, you know, sometime after the last lab. You know, I would recommend attending lab. I hope it's useful. We'll have TAs there. They should be able to help you, but I'm not checking. Whatever works for you, you can do. The always interesting late policy question. So if you have exceptional circumstances, sickness, something else, whatever, contact me. I can often figure something out, especially if you tell me in advance. Otherwise, for homeworks only, if it's 0 to 48 hours late, it's minus 10%. More than 0 and less, up to 48. Minus 15 for 48 to 72 hours late. And otherwise, sorry. I will grade it, but you'll get a 0. I will tell you what you did wrong, but you'll get a 0. And for quizzes and labs, no, because often, not always, we will release answers immediately. So we can't accept late submissions if we've told everyone what the answers to the quiz questions are. We can make other accommodations for illness for those, and things like that. And okay, and I think that's all I have for today. So see you all on Thursday.